Coming up on Tech News Today, what the Surface Pro is good for and whether it's the best in its class. Also, the next Xbox might kill used games. I don't really believe it will. I'll tell you why. And a giant ISP is going to conquer Europe. All that and more coming up.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Tech News Today is provided by CashFly at CACHEFLY.com.
This is Tech News Today for Wednesday, February 6th, 2013. Tech News Today is brought to you by Squarespace, the fast and easy way to create a high-quality website, blog, or online portfolio. For a free trial and 10% off your first purchase on new accounts, go to squarespace.com and use offer code TNT2. And they recently launched a developer platform for complete code control. And by The Resumator. Streamline hiring and increase traffic to job postings with The Resumator, the hiring solution used by today's fastest growing companies. For a free trial, go to theresumator.com/TNT. And by RingCentral. We do everything in the cloud. That's why we love our cloud-based phone system by RingCentral. Zero startup costs, and RingCentral is $20 a month per user. Try it now with a 30-day risk-free trial. Buy one desk phone, get a second phone free up to 20 phones. Call 800-543-9980 or visit RingCentral.com and use our promo code TWIT. Welcome to Tech News Today. I'm Tom Merritt.
I'm Sarah Lane.
I'm Ayaz Akhtar.
And I'm Jason Howell.
And we're all in different
yes, we are.
Locations today for various reasons. But we're all here to keep you up to date on the most important stories in the tech world, starting with the top 10 stories of the day in the news feeds. Like addictive personalities at a support group meeting, more large organizations are admitting I've also been hacked. Now it's the U.S. Federal Reserve System. The U.S. Central Bank told Reuters it has contacted individuals whose personal information was involved in the attack. Crackers posted a list of what appears to be the info for 4,000 U.S. bank executives. The Fed told internal employees that passwords were not compromised.
Twitter's new video clip sharing service, Vine, which has already had its share of controversy after complaints that the content was often graphic and some pornography even made it to an editor's pick, has had its age rating increased to 17 plus in Apple's store. Vine isn't being singled out, though. Tumblr and the photo sharing service 500pics have also seen their iOS apps given mature rating labels over the past couple of weeks.
Bloomberg reports that Google is looking into investing $50 million into Vivo. The deal would give Google an ownership interest in Vivo of less than 10%. The investment would be part of a larger deal where Vivo videos would remain on YouTube. Now over to Tom with sports.
Anybody involved in programming and encryption probably ends up becoming a little bit of fan of prime numbers, right, Ayaz? Well, hey, prime numbers fans, we've got a new 17-million-digit monster at the top of the heap. Curtis Cooper at the University of Central Missouri in Warrensburg, go Mules, has found the new prime while participating in the Great Internet Mersenne Prime search. The number is the 48th Mersenne Prime ever found and the 14th discovered by GIMPs. That's the
That's one of the weirdest news fuses you've ever read, Tom.
Go prime numbers!
In content and delivery. Edge Magazine is reporting that the next version of Xbox will require an internet connection with an activation code for games on 50 gigabytes capacity Blu-ray discs. And it's likely that purchased games will not be able to be resold. Sounds like a good way to prevent piracy, rather, but a great way to upset a lot of gamers. Edge also backs up previous rumors that an AMD CPU will power the next Xbox.
Instagram just launched a web version of its service. You'll be able to view a feed of your friends' photos just like you'd see on the app. However, you can't sign up for Instagram on the site, and you can't upload photos from the web either.
LG needs some seriously impressive hardware to get back into the thick of the smartphone race. And as Mobile World Congress approaches, LG has posted a tease to its Facebook page that says, quote, a new series will be unveiled, promising in the caption that it will have an unexpected distinction. That's great. Hopefully the distinction won't be something nobody wants or cares about.
If you want one of those new BlackBerry devices with a physical keyboard and you live in the U.S., you may have to wait until May or June. CEO Thorsten Hines says the exact release date is going to depend on each wireless provider, but that the BlackBerry Q10 will likely be released 8 to 10 weeks after a carrier releases the Z10, which is BlackBerry's touchscreen device. The Z10 is expected in the U.S. in mid-March, so 10 weeks later pushes it out somewhat.
If you're one of those people who's still worried about the end of Mac Pro sales in Europe March 1st and thinking that that's the sign, it's the end of the Mac Pro, they're going to get rid of it. Well, take heart. Stop worrying. According to an email newsletter published by Mac Forever, Apple, or republished, Apple told France Systeme, that's a manufacturer, or a vendor, that a, quote, new range of Mac Pros will be released in spring 2013. Apple's WWDC takes place in June, usually. June is mostly in spring. So there you go. There's all the parts. Build your own Apple rumor.
The High Court of Australia overturned a decision that found Google liable for deceptive practices with its paid search ads. The original decision found Google liable for misleading ads that appeared on its site because that lower court said Google was responsible for the content of the ads. The High Court of Australia says Google did not create those ads and it should not be responsible for their content.
What a concept. All right, this episode of Tech News Today brought to you by Squarespace, the fast and easy way to create a high-quality website, blog, or online portfolio. We talk a lot about the mobile experience, how they reconvert all your images into 7 sizes. They have the mobile responsive designs. Those award-winning designs look great on any screen size. But what I may not have told you about enough is just how easy it is to use. You may think, wow, that sounds really difficult. That all happens on the back end. You don't have to do anything. All you do is put up your stuff. There's beautiful templates. They have 100% drag-and-drop functionality for all the customization tools. There's a new page builder tool called the Layout Engine that enables you to customize pages in seconds. You just add blocks of content. You want some photos? Add the photo block. Want some videos? Video. Text block. There's even a block that lets you code in it if you really want to. Social media content, all that stuff. And the best part is you preview the layout as you go. Makes it even easier for anyone to build a website. Squarespace gives you better social media integration too. Automatically can import, sync, and publish to and from social media with a few clicks. If you want your Facebook posts or your Google Plus posts to show up there, you can automatically pull photos from Instagram into your site, instantly sync pages and galleries to Facebook, auto publish new blog entries on Twitter. And then you got those buttons for Google Plus, for Twitter, for Facebook, all in there. Squarespace is exceptionally well designed, but you don't have to take my word for it. Go try it out. Sign up for a free account right now. No credit card needed. Just try it out. Start building your website. And if you do decide to keep the service, use the offer code TNT2 and get 10% off your first purchase on new accounts. That includes monthly and annual plans. That's squarespace.com. Use that offer code TNT2. Everything you need to create an exceptional website. And we thank Squarespace for their support of Tech News Today. All right, let's get into discussion time and discuss the news of the day. Joining us to dig a little deeper into these stories is Jason Heiner, editor-in-chief of TechRepublic.com. Good to have you back on the show, man.
Hey, always good to be here.
The only problem, and it's not really a problem, is that now we have two Jasons on the show. So, you know, we'll have to, for the audio listeners, we'll have to
just, you know,
just call do the Jason H and Jason.
Oh, no, just do the football thing. Be like, yo, Heiner. Yo, Howell.
Howell, get in the game.
Yeah, exactly.
Works. All right. Well, speaking of getting the game, Jason Heiner has been playing around with the Surface Pro. Sarah, you've been looking at some of the reviews online. What's up with those?
Yeah, reviews are in. And it sounds like, Jason, you have a lot of the same issues with the Surface Pro that many of the other folks who had review units have, that you know, the battery life is pretty abysmal. The screen is very nice. The kickstand is weird. I mean, you wrote a pretty healthy review over at Tech Republic. What are your initial thoughts?
Yeah, so the one thing that is really interesting about this product is it's very ambitious, right? Probably ultimately a little too ambitious. Microsoft's trying to do a lot, but the main thing they're trying to do is converge, right? Tablet and laptop. And, you know, I've kind of always said from the time they announced this that the real deal is, can they pull that off and make you not feel like you're giving up something, giving up too much, right? Because you're always going to give up something when you do sort of a converged device, but do you give up too much? And there's some things to really like. it was the first time using this device was the first time that I really felt like touch and mouse and keyboard worked well together. And part of it's because of the Metro interface, and part of it's just because of the fact that it's real high res screen, and not only high res, but also the capacity for touch is really good. So it's very accurate. So I found myself doing some things with the mouse, and then other things, you know, mouse and keyboard, like obviously typing longer stuff, doing right click to get into options. And then other things like flipping through photos and scrolling to a specific part of a page and that kind of thing were just easier and better with touch. So it was really the first device that the two, like touch and traditional keyboard and mouse, worked well together. And then on top of it, it also has the pen computing. And I've never been a huge fan of pen computing either, but partly because the one is sort of awkward, and then the lines end up being really big, and you, where you put the pen on the screen isn't always where it shows up, you know, on the screen itself. So it just didn't really work for me. This one actually works really well. The pen's really accurate. It can do really thin lines or really thick lines as you'd like. And so I thought that was the best part about it. It really integrated those three things together really well.
You know, it sounds like, Jason, you might be agreeing with the folks over at Nantech that said the Surface Pro is going to be a device that, you know, if you're already coming from using an Ultrabook, you might really like it because it is that hybrid device. But if you're already familiar with the tablet, it might seem odd.
Totally. I mean, if you're a tablet user already and your idea is like, oh, I carry my tablet and I carry the laptop, maybe I can get this and I can get rid of both, or it'll save me money from my next upgrade. I won't have to get one or the other. I don't think that's the case. Just as a tablet, it kind of is not, it's heavy. It doesn't work well in portrait mode. It really only works usefully in landscape mode. The battery life is only 4 to 5 hours. The tablet, it doesn't have a lot of tablet apps. Obviously, it's full Windows, so it has the whole breadth of Windows software, but it doesn't have good tablet apps. There aren't enough really good tablet apps to make it feel like, you know, you can enjoy the tablet experience. It's much more laptop. I'd call it like 70% laptop and, you know, 25-30% tablet, or whatever the percentages are there. But it's much more tablet than laptop. And I just think you give up too much on both ways. So while it's interesting, I'm not sure how useful it is or how much I would recommend it. I can't really think anybody I would specifically recommend and say, oh, this is what you've been waiting for. Go get one.
Tom, what about you? I mean, you have a laptop. I know you have an iPad, and you've played around with some other tablets as well. Does something that seems to be somewhere in the middle of laptop and tablet appeal to you?
I have the Surface RT, actually, and part of the appeal there was, oh, I can actually do multiple windows on one screen. I can do, you know, I can go to the desktop, I can put IE up, and I can have multiple things. But then I got hung up on the fact that I couldn't, for instance, put an IRC client there. I had to put the IRC on the tablet side, on the Metro or the tiled interface, whatever you call it. And so I was looking forward to the Pro for that reason, but then the battery life scares me off. So I'm curious, mm-hmm. Jason, if you were able to get a sense of what that battery life is like.
Yeah, it's not good. It's much more like a laptop than it is a tablet. I mean, I never got through more than even half a day on the battery. And if you're really using it a lot, then it's draining, you know, 4 hours, maybe even less than 4 hours sometimes if you're doing a lot on it.
Should we call it a lablet?
Tab-top? I mean, even laptops, a lot of the Ultrabooks have better battery life than this guy, right? I mean, it's a lot of those Ultrabooks now will have 8-10 hours of battery life. And so in my review, I put, like, if you're interested in this concept and you're interested in the stuff that Tom talked about, which is very legitimate, I think something like the Lenovo ThinkPad Tablet 2 is probably going to be more interesting to you, right? It has 10 hours of battery life. It's not as slick in terms of like the screen and the hardware, but you can get it with built-in mobile broadband. The pen integrates. It's not something that's loose and you have to remember to bring with you. And it's less money. It's $679. It starts at $679, whereas Surface Pro starts at $899. So I still think even for the people that are interested in a lot of the things that this product does, you know, the better option is going to be some of the stuff from OEMs rather than this Microsoft tablet.
I think you just convinced me to get a Lenovo. All right, Google's in the market to buy something. Vivo, we've kind of mentioned the rumors around this. They're starting to heat up again. AI is.
Yeah, it's purchasing a part of Vivo. It's not going to be buying the entirety of it. Bloomberg reports that YouTube is talking with Vivo about investing $50 million. This would be an equity investment, so this would be a partial ownership of Vivo, giving Google less than 10% of the company. So they don't even have a majority. If they put this money in, Vivo would be valued at $500 million or more. And the investment's part of a much larger deal because YouTube wants to keep Vivo's music on YouTube. YouTube and Vivo's current deal is set to expire in April. And The Guardian reported a similar story back in mid-January. And last year, there was a lot of reports that were rumored around that Vivo was talking to Facebook and MTV-owned Viacom to maybe put its videos over there instead of YouTube. Jason, I'm looking at this deal, and I don't really see a downside for either party. Can you see what would be negative about this, or is this just good business by both parties?
That was me, Jason, right? So, yeah, yes. I think that, yeah, I feel the same way. I'm sort of, I guess it's just a, you know, good business going both ways. Little bit of a head scratcher, but, you know, Google, there's some of these things that I think Google should build, right? You're a big company, you should go and build. This is one that I wonder, you know, Google really should really consider going their own on this one rather than making a deal. But I don't know. I mean, who knows? But it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. I'm just not sure. I'm not sure the huge investment, or that it's not a huge investment. So maybe that's why. Maybe so it's one of those things that it's just a way to a short term gap, right? Something that they could do before maybe they go on their own and do this kind of thing themselves.
Those Vivo videos, though, on YouTube get crazy views. So, I mean, when you think of it that way, this is, you know, it seems like something that that's really powerful for Google. You know, they don't want Vivo to walk over to Facebook and give Facebook the opportunity to, you know, run ad overlays on the videos there.
That's true. It could be one of those things that artists are more comfortable with Vivo, obviously, than they are with Google. Google's still a little scary. And so maybe they're still more comfortable making this deal. Like record labels and artists are more comfortable making this deal with Vivo. And then, you know, Google sort of gets it in the content in on the back door, right? By making a deal maybe that's the answer.
Right, I'm a little skittish of them going in and owning more of the content providers. It's one thing to say we're going to fund partner channels because we want to build up their expertise and eventually let them fly free. It's another thing to just start owning parts of the partners that are providing you the content.
Yeah, and Vivo was formed way back in 2009 when Universal Music and Sony Music made this company. So the thing is, that's why they already have all these deals in place. And like you're saying, Tom, I think you're right. Potentially, I mean, this could be bad for consumers. I mean, if Google's owning parts of other companies instead of rolling out competitors, if Facebook isn't getting into the music game or this other scenario, we're going to pretty much have the status quo for a long time. I don't know if that's necessarily always a good thing.
All right, let's talk about Zynga. They had their earnings report yesterday, and they have been sort of in the same boat as Facebook, a company that was highly touted before they went public, and it seems like they've had nothing but trouble, at least with the stock market, since they went public. What did they report yesterday, Sarah?
Well, you know, they beat the street, if you can believe that, but that is because analysts didn't expect much from Zynga. Zynga's had a really tough year. Not only have they sort of been bleeding, you know, user numbers, but they've had a lot of executives leave. They had to lay off some people. You know, it's been a time of transition. So the revenue that they reported was $311 million. This is for their Q4, with a net loss of $48.6 million for the quarter. Now, you might say, well, what does that all mean? I mean, if you compare that to what the analysts were expecting, they'd estimated Zynga's Q4 revenue would come in at $212.1 million. So you look at 311 analysts go, wow, it looks pretty good. Bookings were down 50% year over year, which is kind of how Zynga looks ahead. So that's not a great trend. For all of 2012, for the entire year, Zynga reported revenue of $1.28 billion, which is up 12% year over year, but a net loss of $209 million. What's interesting is that because the analyst numbers were so low, that, you know, the stock got a little bit of a boost. Shares went up as much as 6% after the earnings report was out yesterday afternoon. And it's kind of funny. The CEO, Mark Pincus, said, you know, of course, they always try to make it as positive as possible. He said, the biggest highlight of the quarter was seeing our team deliver a successful sequel in Farmville 2, a next-generation social game that offers a great experience, blah, blah, blah. He didn't mention some of the other titles that they're axing because they did not actually catch on. I mean, Farmville is still, I think, for many people, if you say Zynga, name one Zynga game, Farmville is the one that people can think of because they haven't had necessarily a lot of success with some of their spinoffs. What's also interesting, I think, is that in this earnings report, Zynga also announced they have never announced their monthly active users numbers before, so there's not a whole lot to compare it to, but that almost a quarter of the company's monthly active users are now playing Zynga games on mobile devices. That's very interesting to me because that's obviously a trend that Zynga really, really wants to get on board with. And if they're at almost a quarter monthly active users on mobile now, and that is a number that can trend upward, Zynga may not look as bad as I thought that they looked just a quarter ago. Because, you know, mobile's kind of the future, especially for some of these games. Are any of you playing Zynga games on mobile devices? Is that a stupid question?
That it's not a stupid question, but no. I'm not playing any Zynga games at all on mobile devices or otherwise.
Sure.
Yeah,
what about you, Jason? Do you think that, you know, Zynga's had a tough year. Is this the way to turn the company around and keep them from people sort of walking away and getting sick of it?
I do think mobile should be a big part of their answer. I've kind of thought for a long time that they needed to disentangle themselves from Facebook, you know, more and more because it was destined to get, you know, to be stuck with the Facebook crowd. And I think that they've made games that they've obviously have shown create enough interest that and are addicting that people really like. And so I've thought for years they should be making mobile apps, right? Network mobile apps. But they were ready to do that. I think Facebook made a big investment in them and sort of kept them. Facebook was very interested, obviously, in keeping them in the Facebook ecosystem. It was a big part of their traffic. But, you know, since then, it's really has become, you know, it's a hits business. Games are anyway. And it is becoming a more and more of a mobile thing. And so they're kind of on the wrong side of they're on the wrong side of history a little bit until they're more mobile. And also, I think that it's just one of those deals where a couple of years ago, everybody you knew was playing Farmville or some kind of Zynga game anymore. You know, I would be getting these invites from friends all the time on Facebook, you know, for this stuff. I mean, I barely see one or two of those a month. Anymore, whereas it used to be, it seemed like several a day. So I think that they're fighting the fact that they're kind of out of favor with users. Users have moved on to mobile and other stuff, you know?
I think of Farmville, I think of like having Pounce and Plurk open in a tab as well. It just, it just seems old now. It's yellowing in my mind. Yep. So I think Zynga, you're right about it being a hits-based business. Zynga needs to have a hit come out on the mobile app that you don't even think about Facebook. Maybe it's integrated with Facebook in lots of great ways, but you just think of it like, oh, if you checked out this great new game, happens to be from Zynga. I think that would be the next step. But as Sarah pointed out, this is actually a positive earnings report for them.
True.
Let's take a quick break and thank our other sponsor for today's show. New sponsor on Tech News Today, The Resumator, the hiring solution for small and fast-growing businesses. If you're a business executive, if you're a hiring manager, or you're an HR, human resources person, here's a way to reduce time spent on hiring tasks by 50% and reduce cost per hire by as much as 85%. I know people who are in the process of hiring people, that's music to their ears. You can replace your HR inbox, your applicant tracking system that never works with the Resumator. It's an end-to-end hiring package that helps manage the entire process from attracting great applicants to picking your next employee. Most of the great companies out there are great because they're very careful about who they bring in and they try to keep them happy. And Twit has grown significantly in the past few years. Very excited about using the Resumator to help be more efficient in the hiring process. Instagram, Pinterest, Tumblr got off the ground with it, and you can too. Here's how it works. It helps you with sourcing, so you attract the good applicants. Helps you with screening, so you can rank them, track them, and spend time only on the applicants that are worth your time. Helps you with the interview process. You can schedule meetings with candidates, collect feedback from your entire team on them. And finally, helps you hire them. You can use it to collaborate and compare to select the best person for the job. Manage that flow of incoming applicants. Focus on the aspects of your business that make you successful instead of spinning your wheels organizing resumes and files. Get better control of the hiring process. If you're a business owner, hiring manager, or HR professional, and you want to save time, money, and increase traffic to your job postings, check out the Resumator. You get a 14-day free trial. Go to theresumator.com/TNT. And after the free trial, their base package of $99 per month will cover 5 open jobs and 5 users. And they offer other packages as well. We thank the Resumator for their support of Tech News Today. Let's move on to what is going to become the biggest internet service provider outside of China, if it's approved. Liberty Global has agreed to merge with Virgin Media. Liberty will spend $23.3 billion on the merger. They will then move their headquarters from Delaware to the United Kingdom. That's just their domicile. It's not actually moving any buildings or people. They're going to keep their headquarters in the U.S., but they will become a U.K. company. Remain trading under the Virgin Media name. 80% of their revenue they expect is going to come from the UK, Germany, Belgium, Switzerland, and the Netherlands. And that means 25 million customers over 14 countries. Compare that. Comcast in the US is a huge ISP and cable company, 18.7 million. So they're going to dwarf them. Virgin operates hybrid cable and fiber service in the UK. And the UK is now becoming an interesting battleground. If you don't know Liberty, they used to own DirecTV. They spun it back out. The Liberty Global is their international arm. They still operate some things in the United States. They're run by John Malone. Now, you may not have heard of his name, but if you're in the cable TV industry, you definitely have heard his name. He's a personality. He's a force to be reckoned with, and he's going up against somebody you probably have heard about, Rupert Murdoch. So it's going to be Virgin versus B-Sky B in Europe. And don't forget, as they point out in the ISP review article, Netflix and Love Film are after those same people, but Netflix and Love Film are carried on the internet service providers. So looking at this battle, looking at this landscape, I feel like this is probably one of the arenas we're now going to see the battle between internet service providers and content providers play out, because what Liberty Global and what News Corp and all of their B-Sky B properties want to do is deliver television, phone, and internet to you. Jason, when you look at this, do you think the internet users should be cheering for anyone in this battle?
It's hard to cheer for either of those, right? It's always hard to cheer for big corporations. I mean, it's just very by the very nature of it, right? And so I think the thing that surprised me about this is that it sounds like such a U.S. deal. To think of this in Europe just feels kind of odd and awkward, right? Because Europe has so many more consumer protections than we do in North America, and they don't really let these companies kind of get super big. They tend not to, right? They have much, much tighter antitrust regulations. And just in the U.S., our laws and general practices of courts just skew toward big companies, and that's why we get such big companies. Whereas in Europe, that's not the case. So that kind of surprises me. You know, this really is a European deal, and the fact that this big conglomerate is there. I mean, and it's not that there aren't others, right? There is already Vodafone. There is already Orange. Both of those go across multiple countries and our big conglomerates across Europe. But the difference there and why I think that this isn't as big of a red flag as it would be something in the U.S. is there's a lot more competition, right? In Europe, you still have a lot of times 3 to 4 choices of these kind of big players for as your provider, whereas in the U.S., we're often limited to 1 or 2. So I don't think it's as much of a red flag as it would be here, but it's certainly one of those things that it's often hard to root for this unless you're somebody that says, oh, I travel to a lot of these countries and maybe that'll make my, you know, maybe I'll get a better roaming deal on my mobile or, you know, temporary internet if I'm traveling to one of those. But other than that, it's tough to find something to cheer for.
Yeah, Liberty Global it doesn't do a whole lot of mobile. But we are going to see them coming up against BSkyB, who have led the way in providing traditional cable television over the internet. They now have a package that allows you to pay £10 a day to get sports. Now, you may not care about sports, but the people who do care about it very much, and it's one of the reasons they haven't cut the cord. So when you look at this four-cornered match here, I think it's going to be very interesting. Another thing that's catching a lot of people's eye is the upcoming game console releases. We're supposed to get Sony and Xbox game console information this year, and a rumor leaking out about Xbox has got some people a little miffed.
Yeah, as Sarah mentioned, Edge Magazine says that the next Xbox will require an always-on internet connection with activation codes for games. The activation code will work for the first buyer of the game and couldn't be used beyond that, which would theoretically rule out secondhand games. That's the one that's getting a lot of press today. On top of that, there were a couple more details in that Edge Magazine piece discussing the specs, pretty much what we've heard before: AMD 8-core processor, 8 gigs of RAM. But interestingly, also in the article is on the developer side, saying that several development sources tell Edge Magazine that developing for the next Xbox is more oppressive than Sony's because Microsoft is only allowing developers to use approved development libraries for the Xbox, while Sony's a little bit more open. But back to this whole potentially no secondhand games. Jason, do you think squashing a secondhand games market would actually have an impact on the next Xbox sales, or is it just too big?
Probably not, just because they're still one of the only players. They're still the leading player in this. Sony's doing, you know, some things, but Sony's coming from behind, is playing from behind on this. I mean, I don't like it. It's one of these things, another one of these things where ultimately you're punishing the people who played by the rules most of the time. The people who don't want to play by the rules, they'll find ways to, you know, make the second hand game market work, or you can hack it, or, you know, jailbreak kind of thing. It's not, I don't think you call it jailbreak on Xbox, but you know what I mean, right? You're going to find ways around it. But the people who, you know, who play by the rules and are trying to play their games, and what it ends up happening is, you know, if you have two Xboxes, or you go to, you know, over to, you know, your grandmom's house and you want to sign in on your Xbox and get your games, well, now it's not going to work right? If you try to do it, I'm sure that's part of the problem, and they want to end up making you buy that game twice. And so that part I don't like. And is it going to hurt? I don't think there's enough competition in the games market and console market yet for that to be a problem. Partly because I think that, you know, more and more games, really the game sales, if you look at the numbers, I mean, they are migrating to mobile. And so while the next generation Xbox is going to be cool, and I think it's good that they are going sort of digital only, I still think it's becoming a more and more highly specialized market. And I don't think it's going to be something that we're going to be talking about or getting all that excited about all that much longer, at least not on a general, you know, market scale.
Tom, with these rumors leaking out about what the Xbox can do, the next one, and these sources saying that the developers are somewhat less happy with Microsoft when it comes to the Xbox, should Microsoft be saying something to the public? Should they be issuing statements saying, look, we're not doing that? Or should the secrecy continue while these rumors are being spread?
Yes, it is Microsoft's incumbent responsibility to tell us whether every rumor is true or not. And fight. Now, I mean, Microsoft's going to make their announcement when they make their announcement, and that's when it's time for spin control. I don't think they need to be addressing this until they're ready.
Why would they say, gamers, you're very upset about this rumor? We'd like to confirm a couple months before E3 to give you a chance to get really upset that we're going to do this. I mean, this is, if it's true, I mean, I almost want to say, and we were talking about Ouya yesterday being in, you know, a bunch of different retail stores. It just gives alternate consoles that much more of a chance to kind of make it, you know, to be a big player, because people get, you know, angry about this sort of thing. I agree that if you want an Xbox and you like everything else about whatever the new version is going to be like, you know, it's, this probably isn't a deal breaker, but there's still, you know, there's enough of the market that might really, really start paying attention to other alternatives to change the game a bit.
I think here's what I think is going to happen. Xbox and PS3 both are going to have the option for developers to create a way that you have to have the game check and see if it's valid before you can play it. I just can't imagine that either one would shut it down entirely so that old games wouldn't play when there's no system for checking on them, or that every game that you buy on disc would have to play be this way. Maybe they will, and I think this idea of fighting against the used game market is just ridiculous. The used game market is going to die with optical storage anyway. You don't need to fight against this anymore.
If you look at the way that Microsoft has acted in the past too, with some, this is in keeping with the ways that they've done things, right? They're in close cahoots with BSA, the software, you know, the guys that go after people for software problems. They've introduced all the product activation stuff and all that. So, what, you know, fair or not, you can see where this is in keeping with a lot of the tactics that Microsoft has used in their fight to combat sort of piracy and sharing and other people, you know, using older stuff and secondhand stuff and all of that. And so it's distasteful, and I hope it's not true, but it shouldn't surprise anybody.
All right, let's finish up with Silent Circle. They launched their first two apps last fall. You may or may not have heard about them. They allow you to do phone and text messages in encrypted apps so that no one can spy on them and no one can tell what you're doing. This is great for human rights activists. In fact, it's even been used by human rights activists. Their iOS and Android apps. They now have a data sharing service that will be added to their text messaging app. Silent Circle Text, coming this end of this week, February 8th, will get the ability to send encrypted data. So that means you can send PDFs, you can send documents, you can send videos. So this definitely helps the people who want to make use of this in documenting, you know, any kind of anti-human rights activity. The company, in case you haven't heard of it, involves Phil Zimmerman, who created PGP. Not bad there. John Callis, who created Apple's whole disk encryption scheme. Not bad there. And Vincent Mascaritolo, apologies if I mispronounce, who actually worked with PGP and Apple's whole disk encryption. So a real talented team here. And what they do is peer-to-peer encryption, up to 60 megabytes of file that can be sent through Silent Text. The file is on a timer, so it can burn after a period of time. It just deletes itself. It can't be unencrypted after that point. It's called Cloud Broker technology, where they slice the file up. It's based on modified convergent encryption. That's content hash keying. Bitkasa uses that. And that allows you to tell that something is part of a file without knowing what is in the file. Now, that is open to a confirmation of file attack, so it's not 100% secure. The servers from Silent Circle keep no data, but metadata. The IP logs expire after 7 days, and the keys are stored with the client. They say they will not allow surveillance from any kind of government agency, and they will not build any back doors. And if the government has a problem with that, they'll move their company somewhere else. It's not cheap. It's $20 a month for the service. And there's a lot of controversy over whether they should release the source code for this or not. Not because of an open source concern, but because of a security concern. Security professionals, when looking at this sort of thing, want to be able to examine the source code. They say we will release the source code by March or April. Human rights reporters in Afghanistan, Jordan, South Sudan have tried the data transfer capability. They've tried it out. They've used it to send photos, voice recordings, videos, and PDFs securely. So, Jason Heiner, what do you think of this? You know, the obviously it's a blade that cuts two ways. It can be used by the bad guys as well. But Silent Circle says it's 99% of the time used by people who need this kind of privacy.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's good. I think they've made good technology, and you know, this kind of stuff is needed. There's plenty of examples you can find where, you know, invasion of privacy or hacking to get into stuff. I mean, just look at the stuff of all the things with China getting into the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal and other places lately, right? To show that you know, hackers are out there lurking, trying to grab stuff. So I totally get why People want to be extra careful and use stuff like this. So in terms of them saying they should, they should open the code. I don't know. Obviously you can make a case both ways for that.
Yeah. I as Sarah, either one of you, have a perspective on this. The idea of being able to send encrypted data from your phone is very handy.
Well, I think it's not just handy, but we actually have to have an option like this. And we talk so much about how people are using their mobile devices for a variety of things that they didn't necessarily, turn to at first, not too long ago. So this is something, this is technology that needs to be there. People are on mobile now.
And the thing is, when it comes to this kind of security and this kind of encryption, like people or companies like RIM that hang their hat on security, they should be freaking out. Because if iOS via just an app can get as secure as something like the way RIM's network is, BlackBerry's network, maybe this is something to be fearful of. Because this kind of security is not easy to come by. And when it comes to operating systems being hardened from the inside out, if you can just do it via an app, that changes pretty much everything, because that means Android can be as secure as iOS can be as secure as BlackBerry, which could be really interesting in the whole market.
Yeah
it's a good point.
I think trumps convenience.
One thing that I think is destined to happen is a lot of this stuff is destined to fade into the background, right? Usability and innovation always runs ahead of security and, manageability and that kind of thing. And that's what's kind of gotten RIM in trouble, right? People want the usability. And so, but this stuff is destined to be available on every smartphone, on every system that you use, and you sort of check a box or, you have easy ways to do it. But until we get to that point, right, until all the back-end systems catch up with the devices that we have and use and are using, you need stuff like this that are a bridge solution that allow you to keep really sensitive stuff secure. So, hat tip to these guys.
Let's finish up with the Rendivisor. It's our attempt to cover some fun stuff, things you might not always hear about. And some folks at the Harriet Watt University in Edinburgh, Scotland, have developed a method for 3D printing clusters of human embryonic stem cells in a variety of sizes. Now, what's really interesting about this is these stem cells are very fragile. So pushing them through the nozzles in a 3D printer has been pretty much impossible up until now. And what it allows you to be able to do is make human tissue models for drug testing and possibly lead down the road to the ability to create in a 3D printer a human organ that is made from someone's stem cells, so it's perfectly compatible with that person.
Wow. Man, when I was reading this article, I was just psyched. My dad was a doctor, so we talked about this kind of stuff all the time. I have a bio degree, so I was staring at this article like, oh my gosh, the ability to have transplantable organs that would not be rejected, and you wouldn't have to worry about matching people and have these massive databases when it comes to getting people what they need. I mean, these human organs are obviously very important. And the fact that you could diminish animal testing on top of that, I was like, we've got to talk about the story.
Yeah, no, I think this is just fascinating. And we've heard about printing out your own organs before, but this is this is the first time I've read a story where it's like, no, we can actually get pretty close. We'll be able to print human tissue with this. That's an incredible advance.
Fascinating. On a less innovative or maybe equally innovative but less important kind of level, I read a story, similar story like this lately, of people doing the same, or scientists doing the same thing, where they are doing this with meat, so that not that interesting to me. I'm a vegan, but I know that that for people who eat meat and but still care about sort of animal and animal treatment, right? It's like, oh, we can use this. We're going to be able to use 3D printers to print meat in labs instead of raising animals. There you go. Print out a burger. Total.
All right, real quickly, I want to thank our other sponsor for today's show, Ring Central. We've told you about Ring Central before. When we built the studio in Petaluma, we wanted an easy and inexpensive and convenient way to handle phone calls because we had a big space. We couldn't all share one phone anymore, but we didn't want to spend a bunch of money building those big, complex old systems called PBX down in the basement of the studio. So we decided to go with Ring Central. Russell, our IT guy, said, hey, it's a cloud-based phone system. No brainer, right? So that's what we do. RingCentral allows us to easily customize all of our call handling. We can get our voicemail in our email, and get our fax messages right on our smartphones. People still want to send us faxes. Now it's not as big of a deal. And they have a new feature, Business SMS. You can send text messages to customers and colleagues from your business phone number. You don't have to use your personal phone number. If you want to send someone a text, but you're like, I don't really want them blowing up my texts all the time, now you can use your RingCentral phone to do Business SMS. RingCentral offers all-inclusive pricing as low as $20 a month per user. You can start right now with a 30-day risk-free trial. They have a special offer for our listeners. When you buy one desk phone, get a second phone free up to 20 phones. So call this number. It's for our listeners, 800-543-9980. That's 800-543-9980. Once again, 800-543-9980. Or go to ringcentral.com and use the promo code TWIT. That's ringcentral.com, promo code TWIT. We thank RingCentral for their support of Tech News Today. Maybe you can thank them as well. Let's see what's on the calendar.
Tomorrow is, it's kind of a quiet day, but LinkedIn is going to announce its earnings. Oh, earnings season just rolls on. So we're rooting for you, LinkedIn.
I'm going to endorse them.
That's good. Yeah. I constantly can you, get those can emails. You endorse LinkedIn with just one quick click? You don't even really have to like LinkedIn that much.
Let's see what's incoming.
Incoming message.
We got an email from Audie. He says, AT&T crew, so after listening to yesterday's show and hear you talk about digital wallets, I'm surprised you didn't mention one of the obvious reasons they haven't taken off yet. Phone carriers. Just look at Google Wallet and tell me how accessible a mobile wallet is. Some carriers won't let their users have it at all and then waste time trying to get their own mobile wallet together and then lag even further. I'm with Ayaz. I think only Apple has the gravitas to push something out that the general public will accept because for whatever reason, Google can't or won't. It's an interesting point. Phone carriers have been causing a lot of issues.
I still believe that the Square app on iOS and Android is the best way to do this. The geofencing thing, I used it the other day. I used to use it at the coffee shop in Petaluma all the time. Used it at a coffee shop called Balcony right over here in Los Angeles. And it worked perfectly. I hadn't even used the Square app in a while since I moved, pulled it out, opened it up, paid for the coffee. No problem. I still think that's the way.
Amazon and Apple. Those are the two. They've already got everybody's deets, right? You're already comfortable paying with them through them. I just think it's only a matter of time before both of them have e-commerce digital wallet solutions.
Got another email from Joe. This is a very creative one because he hand wrote it with a Wacom style. Okay, here's what he said. He said, a quick note about Wacom and their tech. First, it is a screen technology, not a stylus. Yes, they have special styli, but the real advantage of Wacom is the screen underlay. As a tablet user since 2005, I get frustrated by the dismissive tone from folks using capacitive styli. A real digitizer allows for on-screen writing as clear as normal pen and ink. An active digitizer plus OneNote plus a tablet is the best productivity tool I've ever had. Second, styli are not primarily pointers. They're creation tools. For some, that's art. For others, it's notes. But in both cases, we can use our fingers and a styli. It's not an either or. Also, handwritten emails are fun. And Joe, I totally agree. And I'm sorry that sometimes I have a hard time reading your handwriting, but it's very nice.
It wasn't for any problem in the devices.
Certainly not. It's because cursive is a dying technology.
Yeah. And those were good points, Joe. Thanks for writing literally into the show. All right, that's it for the show. Thank you, Jason Heiner, for joining us. Always great to have you, man. Let folks know what's going on with you and where they can find you online.
Sure. So you can find me on Twitter at Jason Heiner. You can find me at jasonheiner.com. That's where all my stuff is. And also check out one of the cool new things that we're doing across Tech Republic and ZDNet right now is each month we're doing a special report on one big topic, and we're taking content from across all of our editors and writers in four regions. So Asia, Australia, US, and Europe. And we're putting together special reports on topics. So this month is the consumerization of IT and the bring your own device stuff. So we've got lots of really great long form content. You can find that if you go to ZDNet.com. You will see starting later today, if you look on the nav, there'll be a little link for BYOD, and you can go there and you can read all of the stuff we've got. We have lots of really great advice and best practices and case studies and all kinds of great stuff. So
that's great. I love that. And there's so many tech publications out there now doing this sort of like long form journalism. It gives me hope that maybe mainstream journalism will catch on, like, hey, look at these guys over at ZDNet. Look what they're doing. We can all do that. It's worthwhile. So cool stuff. That awesome. Is it for us. You can find our subreddit, technewstoday.reddit.com, and submit stories if there's something you think we should talk about, or you just want to see what other people are interested in and vote them up or down. No, I don't want them to talk about that. You can vote down too. technewstoday.reddit.com. You can find us on the web, twit.tv/TNT. You can email us, TNT@twit.tv, or give us a call, leave us a voicemail. Our phone number is 260-TNT-SHOW. It's a Google Voice number, but it's a free call in Butler, Indiana. We'll be back tomorrow with Mike Schramm as our guest. We'll see you then.